You are now listening to Jess's Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Jess's Lit. We are back with another episode of the Shakespeare Sonnets. We left off just reading Sonnet 110 last episode, and so we'll start off reading it again just to kind of refresh our minds, and then go on from there with the close analysis. We are getting a bit of rain today. I'm kind of happy we are because it's been very sunny and scorching sun lately. But yeah, it was nice to kind of get the wet rain we haven't gotten in a while. But other than that, nothing much going on. I have a couple songs to play for you guys before we get into the sonnets. And then couple of ads, show promos, and PSAs as well, and so we will get into the readings just after those. The first two songs that will be played is called Flower Mind and Last Bite, both by Blair Lee, and so we'll be right back after this. Thank you.
blend equal parts science and stories. Add a few shakes of music and soundscape, and wrap it all up in a big question. How can we see this more than human world in a new light and take part in shaping a healthy Anthropocene? Catch Future Ecologies every Sunday at 8 a.m. on CITR.
Are you interested in radio? Do you want to start your own show but you don't know where to get started? Make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From the news collective, the arts collective, the music collective, the sports collective, the accessibility collective, the indigenous collective, and the intersectionality collective, there's something for everyone. And we provide free technical training to get started. Explore these worlds virtually and in person, and be prepared to make fun friends. For more information, visit citr.ca/get involved.
If the news are getting you down or you're tired of scrolling on your phone, Massey Books is the one-stop shop for you. A 100% Indigenous-owned business that is committed to giving back to local charities, community initiatives, and organizations, Massey Books has a vast selection of rare and unique books, as well as a diverse range of books that are from underrepresented authors. You can shop online at masseybooks.com or visit their store on 229 East Georgia Street in Chinatown. They are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday, and 12 to 5 from Sunday to Tuesday. Their friendly staff would love to give you a hand to find your new favorite read. Are you looking to decolonize your self-care routine? Take a trip down to Sisters Sage for a variety of handmade soaps, bath fizzies, smudge sprays, and salves infused with traditional plant medicines. Sisters Sage is an award-winning local Indigenous business run by Tsimshian and entrepreneur, activist, and community builder Lynn Marie Angus and her dog TJ. Passionate about crafting wellness products that are respectful of the land we live on, Sisters Sage is committed to a heart-centered approach to self-care as well as our collective healing. Located on 1312 Kingsway, you can drop by from Monday to Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. See you there!
Randomphobic is best thought of as an introversal jukebox which has no concept of genre, style, political boundaries, or even space-time relevance. But it does know good sounds from bad. Lately, the program has been focused on Philip Random's All Vinyl Countdown plus Apocalypse, the 1111th greatest records you probably haven't heard. And we're not afraid of noise. Randomphobic, every Saturday at 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. at CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back. You just finished listening to Flower Mind and Last Bite by Blair Lee and some ads, show promos, and PSAs. We'll get right into Sonnet 110. Alas, 'tis true, I have gone here and there and made myself a motley to the view, gored mine own thoughts, sold cheap what is most dear, made old offences of affections new. Most true it is that I have looked on truth akance and strangely, but by all above, these blenches gave my heart another youth. And worse essays proved thee my best of love. Now all is done, have what shall have no end. Mine appetite I never more will grind on newer proof to try an older friend. A god in love to whom I am confined, then give me welcome, next my heaven the best, even to thy pure and most loving breast. So here, when we look at lines 1 to 4, we are opened with a confession. The speaker admits to emotional or perhaps even physical wandering, and we could see that in the phrase gone here and there, and describes this movement as a kind of foolish public display. Motley is the garb of a court jester, a fool, and the phrase made myself a motley to the view in a sense signals shameful self-exposure, perhaps even a betrayal of dignity. when he is, quote-unquote, gored mine own thoughts, a violent metaphor of self-harm that is, and it suggests inner betrayal or the wounding of personal convictions. The phrase sold cheap, what is most dear, implies he squandered something sacred, which could be love, truth, or emotional integrity, and squandered those sacrednesses for something unworthy. And the final line of the quatrain, made old offenses of affections new, is ambiguous, but may suggest that he repeated past romantic misdeeds under the guise of new desires. And so we feel a deep tone of cyclical guilt and a sense of self-recognition here with the first four lines. Moving on to lines 5 and 8. Now here the speaker deepens the contrition, or his contrition. He admits that he has not only acted wrongly, but has failed to see the truth straight on. And that is apparent in the phrase, looked on truth askance and strangely. And so there's a platonic undercurrent here where the lovers return to the truth. We can see that in the phrase, beloved, after being seduced by shadows and appearances. Nonetheless, despite all that, there's a surprising turn that occurs, and we can see that in the phrase, these blenches gave my heart another youth. And so blenches here means hesitations or moral lapses, and despite their shame, they are paradoxically generative. He experiences a kind of spiritual renewal through the error, and we could see this being a Christian-inflected idea, where fallenness leads to grace. And similarly, in the phrase, worse essays proved thee my best of love, now that phrase suggests that his failed attempts with others clarified the unmatched value of the beloved. It's an admission that carries both humility and awe. We go into lines 9 to 12. We are presented with the volta in line 9, bringing finality and resolution. And so the phrase, now is all done, is the turning point. The speaker's wandering is ultimately over, and he is recommitted. The phrase, have what shall have no end, sounds almost like a vow of external devotion. And the phrase, mine appetite I never more will grind on your proof, extends the metaphor of appetite as desire or temptation, and that he will no longer test old love against new enticements. The phrase, to try an older friend, suggests that the beloved is not just a romantic figure, but also an anchoring companion. And this culminates in the phrase, a God in love to whom I am confined, which elevates the beloved to divinity. The final couplet, lines 13 and 14, the poem ends with a plea for acceptance, almost like a prayer. The doubling of most emphasizes the excess of feeling and the urgency of the speaker's desire to be embraced again. It's a gesture of deep vulnerability also. The phrase, next my heaven, the best, suggests the beloved's embrace is second only to divine salvation. Also can be seen as a profoundly spiritualized vision of love. And so that was Sonnet 110. Moving on to Sonnet 111. Oh, for my sake do you with fortune chide the guilty goddess of my harmful deeds that did not better for my life provide than public means which public manners breeds. Thence comes it that my name receives a brand, and almost thence my nature is subdued to what it works in like the dyer's hand, pity me then and wish I were renewed. Whilst like a willing patient I will drink potions of isle gainst my strong infection, no bitterness that I will bitter need or bitter think, nor double penance to correct correction. Pity me then, dear friend, and I assure ye that even that your pity is enough to cure me. Now, in this first of two linked poems, the poet blames fortune for putting him in a profession that ultimately leads to his bad behavior, and he begs the beloved to punish him and to pity him. And to kind of analyze deeper into this, moving on to lines 1 and 2, the speaker opens with a passionate appeal. He asks his friend to blame fortune and on his behalf. And so fortune here is cast as guilty, a personification of chance or fate that has orchestrated his harmful, quote-unquote, harmful deeds. And so this is a deflection of responsibility, but not a total denial as well. The speaker implies that his faults arise from circumstances outside his control, which is kind of the deals with the struggle between fate and moral agency. With lines 3 and 4, the speaker laments that fortune did not grant him a more noble or private station in life. He was thrust into public life, perhaps as an actor or someone with a sullied reputation. The phrase public means suggests a livelihood that exposes one to social corruption, manners shaped by public life, not personal virtue. And there's also a moral contagion implied, which deals with the exposure to the public and how that degrades the self. With lines 5 and 6, the speaker's name is quote-unquote branded, a metaphor evoking stigma, shame, and even criminality. This line also alludes to the indelibility of reputation. Not only is his name, but his very nature, his character or essence has been quote-unquote subdued, weakened or transformed by this exposure. And the phrase almost events signals some lingering hope, whereas corruption isn't total, yet he is deeply marked. Line 7, to what it works in, like the dyer's hand. We're presented with a simile, like a dyer whose hands are stained by the dye they work with. The speaker has been colored, also could be seen as permanently altered by his environment. And this metaphor speaks to the material intimacy and irreversible transformation, where you cannot remain untouched by what you work in. There's also a subtle class commentary where the dyer is a laborer marked by his trade, and the speaker identifies with this working class embodiment. With lines 8 and 9, the speaker asks not for scorn or judgment, but pity. He seeks renewal, spiritual or moral, whatever it may be, and he adopts the position of the quote-unquote willing patient. A passive but cooperative recipient of healing. And so this metaphor ultimately shifts the tone from accusation to penance and from deflection to vulnerability. With lines 10 to 11, the isle means vinegar in this sense, a bitter substance sometimes used for medicinal purposes. The speaker will drink any harsh cure, no matter how bitter, if it will treat his quote-unquote strong infection, a metaphor for his moral or emotional illness. He is committed to redemptive suffering, and bitterness becomes a kind of spiritual remedy to him. With lines 12, nor double penance, the correct correction, or to correct correction, this line is significant because it kind of, so even if the remedy from before entails excessive punishment, and that's seen as the phrase double penance, the speaker will not resist it. And the phrase correct correction suggests a self-reinforcing discipline, punishment upon punishment, but the speaker embraces this as necessary for healing. The final couplet, the poem ends with a emotional turn. Despite all the talk of infection, correction, and bitter medicine, it is ultimately the beloved's pity alone that can heal him. And this is a reversal of the earlier metaphors. Emotional care becomes the true cure, more potent than vinegar or penance. The speaker's emotional world is governed not by abstract fate or divine justice, but by the intimate grace of interpersonal affection. And so that was Sonnet 111. Moving on to Sonnet 112. Your love and pity doth the impression fill, which vulgar scandal stamped upon my brow. For what care I who calls me well or ill, so you over green my bad, my good allow. You are my all over the world, you are my all the world, and I must strive to know my shames and praises from your tongue. None else to me, nor I to none alive, that my steeled sense or changes right or wrong. In so profound abysm I throw all care of others' voices that my adder's sense to critic and to flatter stopped are. Mark how with my neglect do I dispense. You are so strongly in my purpose bred that all the world besides me thinks are dead. And so here we are kind of we're able to reflect upon the sonnet right before to kind of compare and contrast. And so the pity asked for in Sonnet 111 has here been received. And the poet, therefore, has no interest in others' opinions of his worth or behavior. And so lines 1 and 2, the speaker opens with the metaphor of a stamp or impression on the brow, which is an image of public shame or disgrace. And vulgar scandal refers to common, low, or popular rumor. Yet love and pity from the beloved have the power to fill in or overwrite this mark. The term fill suggests not just covering over, but repairing or reforming. And so through this, we can see that love becomes restorative and almost redemptive. The implication here is that the public disgrace loses its power when love intervenes, and that love can rewrite identity where shame once inscribed it. With lines 3 and 4, these lines express a defiance of public opinion. The phrase well or ill encapsulates both praise and blame. The word overgreen is especially rich, as it suggests rejuvenation, as if the beloved can make what is bad lush and living again. There's also a transactional feel here as well in these two lines, where as long as you approve, I do not care what others say. And it is both romantic and existentially isolating at the same time. With lines 5 and 6, the phrase all the world signals the speaker's total devotion. The beloved replaces society and becomes a sole moral and effective compass. The phrase strive suggests effort or labor, knowing one's worth or shame only through the beloved's words implies a dependency, a kind of emotional servitude or surrender of self-definition. Moving on to lines 7 and 8, the syntax here is, we're presented with a complex set of syntaxes as it asserts total isolation from others emotionally and morally. The phrase steeled sense suggests a hardened, resolute perception, one that is only mutable through the beloved. The phrase changes right or wrong implies that only the beloved can alter his perception of morality. That is, the beloved doesn't just judge him, but defines what is right or wrong. With lines 9 to 11, the abysm means a deep abyss, and this metaphor conveys the total obliteration of care for others' opinions. The phrase adder sense is an allusion to the biblical serpent that stops its ears, and that is a metaphor for willful deafness. The speaker thus deafens himself to both praise, as in the phrase flatterer, and blame in the phrase critic, seeing both as irrelevant. And the stanza marks a total withdrawal from society, where love enacts a kind of emotional monasticism. The last couple lines here is significant. We can see that in the phrase neglect, and how that refers to the deliberate refusal to engage with others' opinions, and to dispense with something is to cast it off as well. The beloved is quote-unquote bred into his quote-unquote purpose, implying deep integration, like extinct or identity. She's no longer external, but internalized. The final line is stark, where the world is dead to him, not just ignored, but ultimately dead. And this hyperbolic isolation ultimately elevates love into a metaphysical extreme, where the beloved becomes the only living presence, and all else ultimately vanishes. And so that was Sonnet 112. Before we move on to Sonnet 113, I have two songs to play for you guys. The first song is called Deadweight, and the second one is called This Song Sucks, and they're both from Jade Turner. And so we'll be right back after this.
Got it real hard. It cut me to the core. That's where I learned how to keep my head down. But I'm not doing that anymore. Whatever the cost is, I'm gonna cut. Just dead weight. Feeling I'm not good enough. That sure is real tough. I don't like feeling this way. Looking at the big screen, but I don't see me. Yeah, something's got. Of who I wanna be. They can hate.
This song sucks. I used to play it on repeat. Back when it was you and me. Had a pretty little shiny ring. This song sucks. Used to get me in the feels. Up until you broke the deal. Now I don't feel a single thing. I catch your little melody. But I remember what you did to me. I hate that it's still stuck. Cause this song sucks. This song sucks. You used to sing me every line. Nothing but a waste of time. This song sucks. Yeah, you left me in the dust. I'm lucky that I'm tough. Now I don't really give up. I catch your little melody. But I remember what you did to me. I hate that it's still stuck. Cause this song sucks. Just when I started sleeping through the night. Just when I think I'm finally feeling alright. Just when I start to sing a brand new tune. Just when I think I'm finally rid of you. A catchy little melody. But I remember what you did to me. I hate that it's still stuck.
Hey, we tried to call you.
You just finished listening to Deadweight and The Song Sucks by Jade Turner. Sonnet 113. Since I left you, mine eye is in my mind, and that which governs me to go about doth parts his function, and is partly blind, seems seeing but effectually is out. For no form delivers to the heart of bird, of flower, or shape with which it doth latch. Of his quick objects hath the mind no part, nor his own vision holds what it doth catch. For if it sees the reddest or gentlest sight, the most sweet favor or deformed creature, the mountain or the sea, the day or night, the crow or dove, it shapes them to your feature. Incapable of more, replete with you, my most true mind, this maketh mine mine untrue. So here the poet confesses that everything he sees is transformed into an image of the beloved. With lines 1 to 4, we begin with a paradox. His eyes are no longer outward facing, but turned inward, now residing in quote-unquote, his mind. This suggests a collapse between vision and memory. Rather than perceiving the world directly, his eye merely reflects the inner image of the beloved. And so this is just beautifully put here as the eye not outward-facing but inward-facing, which is beautiful in my sense because, and it's also really the reason why I love Shakespeare, is the beautiful play of words and the switching and twisting of just different perceptions through the words is just really, really nice and well put. It really gets you to imagine what it really is like if your eyes turn inwards and looks into your brain, into your mind, in a sense. And so the line, that which governs me to go about, likely refers to sight as a guiding faculty, which is now partly blind And this partial blindness, in a sense, signals a disjunction between physical sight and emotional spiritual perception. Though the eye seems seeing, it is effectually out, and that implies that it's visually or visibly open, but psychically blind to anything but the beloved. With lines 5 and 8, these lines continue to distinguish between the eye's mechanical function and the emotional truth of what it has seen. And so even though the eye latches or catches the forms of birds, flowers, or other objects, none of these reach the heart, and they don't emotionally register as well. And so the final line intensifies the dissociation, where even the eye cannot hold what it catches, and that suggests that sensory experience is evacuated of meaning when it isn't filtered through the beloved's image, through the speaker's brain. Lines 9 to 12, these lines present a litany of visual opposites. We can see that in the contrasting of rude and gentle, beautiful, ugly, sublime, prosaic, dark and light, and ominous and innocent. And that is to demonstrate the total dominance of the beloved's image. Regardless of what the speaker sees, his vision superimposes the beloved's face on everything. The phrase, "it shapes them to your feature," suggests a projective transformation, where the beloved becomes the form through which all perception is filtered. The concluding couplet reflects a effective turn where in the speaker's mind, he's replete with you and is so full that it has no room left for anything else. Hence, the mind's very fidelity leads to a kind of falsehood, disorienting perception. And the quote-unquote I becomes untrue, not through deception, but through excess of devotion and inner saturation. And so that was Sonnet 113. Moving on to Sonnet 114. "Or whether doth my mind, being crowned with you, drink up the monarch's plague, this flattery? Or whether shall I say mine, I saith true, and that your love taught it this alchemy, to make of monsters and things indigest such cherubins as your sweet self resemble, creating every bad a perfect best, as fast as objects to his beams assemble. Oh, 'tis the first, 'tis flattery in my seeing, and my great mind most kingly drinks it up. Mine eye well knows what with his gust is greeing, and to his palate doth prepare the cup. If it is be poisoned, 'tis the lesser sin, than mine eye loves it and doth first begin." Now, in a continuation of the sonnet before, Sonnet 113, the poet debates whether the lovely images of the beloved are true or are the mind's delusions. And he ultimately, though, decides on the latter. With lines 1 and 2, the speaker begins with a rhetorical question. His mind, crowned with you, suggests that the beloved reigns sovereign over his thoughts. This regal metaphor is extended as he compares his love-induced perception to a monarch afflicted by the plague of flattery. With lines 3 and 4, the speaker considers another possibility. Perhaps his eye sees truly, and what others call distortion is in fact a refined perception taught by love. The word alchemy here suggests a magical transformation, turning base matter, which is ugliness in the sense, into gold, and in the sense, beauty. And so love then acts as a powerful and irrational force here that transfigures the real. Or transfigures reality. With lines 5 and 6, the alchemy here supposedly enables his vision to transform the monstrous and grotesque, seen in the phrase "things indigest," into angelic beauty in the phrase "cherubins," resembling the beloved. The hyperbolic metaphor points to how love idealizes, remaking even the repulsive into the beloved's image. There's also an irony here. He may be aware that this perception is distorted, yet he still indulges in it, which is a bit ironic. With lines 7 and 8, the process is automatic. Let me just read you lines 7 and 8. Creating every bad a perfect best, as fast as objects to his beams assemble. So it's a question. And so the process here is automatic. Everything the eye can see is beautified, turned from bad to best, as quickly as it enters his field of vision. And the phrase beams, implying rays of sight. And there's a note of helplessness here, a loss of critical faculties under the spell of love. With lines 9 to 10, O tis the first tis flattery in my seeing, and my great mind most kingly drinks it up. The speaker now answers the question. It is flattery. So in the two lines before, there was a couple, actually in the first two lines, drink up the monarch's plague, this flattery. So is it the flattery? It's asking. But in lines 9 to 12, it is confirmed it is flattery, and my great mind most kingly drinks it up. And so flattery it is, and he confesses his mind is corrupted by desire to praise and adore, is corrupted by the desire to praise and adore, just like a king who loves hearing only what pleases him. The word kingly echoes the earlier crowned image, and he acknowledges that his mental sovereignty has been seduced. Moving on to lines 11 to 12, mine eye well knows what with his gust is greeing, and to his palate doth prepare the cup. Here the eye is likened to a taster, anticipating the mind's desires and quote-unquote preparing the cup that flatters the senses. The metaphor is gastronomic. The eye feeds the mind what it wants to consume. And so there's a willful collusion between perception and thought here. And the final couplet, if it be poisoned, tis the lesser sin, that mine eye loves it and doth first begin. And so even if this cup of flattery is poisoned, false or harmful, the speaker excuses it. So even if the flattery is poisoned, and so even if the flattery is harmful, untrue, or poisoned, the speaker will dismiss it and excuse it. It is a lesser sin that the eye loves and initiates the deception. And so this final couplet is both cynical and resigned, as it recognizes the delusion, yet forgives it because love is the ultimate source. And so the poison of idealization is still preferable to the bitter truth in the poem's sense. And so that was Sonnet 114. We are running out of time, and so I will just read Sonnet 115 for you guys, and kind of allow you guys to think about it, and then we can discuss it next episode. And so that this here is Sonnet 115. Those lines that I before have writ do lie, even those that said I could not love you dearer, yet then my judgment knew no reason why. My most full shame or flame should afterwards burn clearer, but reckoning time, whose millioned accidents creep in twixt vows and change decrees of kings, tan sacred beauty, blunt the sharpest intents, divert strong minds to the of the course of altering things. Alas, why fearing of time's tyranny, might I not then say, now I love you best, when I was certain over uncertainty, crowning the present, doubting of the rest. Love is a babe, then might I not say so, to give full growth to that which still doth grow. And so that was Sonnet 115. We will end today's episode here. We did a bit of close analysis of four very famous poems here. And so we will kind of leave it on to the next episode of Sonnet 115, and we'll continue off then. But yeah, that is the end of today. I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your week and have a good summer. I hope everyone's having a good summer. After my trip back to Korea, I've just been resting and I'm trying to get into some more readings. I've been slowly being interested by the author Han Kang, who won the Nobel Literature Prize, the first ever Korean to ever win it. And so that was exciting. I am getting interested in her works. And so we'll see. Maybe a book review or just a literature review on Han Kang is coming your way. I'm not quite sure. I don't really have much planned after the Shakespeare Sonnet series. And so if you guys do have any recommendations or wants for me to kind of go over, depends on whether poems or books or whatever it may be. Just if you guys have any recommendations, please feel free to shoot me a text, email, or just whatever. If you guys have a wonderful rest of your week, and I will see you guys again next week on Wednesday. Thank you all for joining. I'll see you again. Bye-bye.
Second thing that's like kind of a finale to the whole album, and there's like a sentence